You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello and good afternoon, everyone. I'm Joe Hallgut and I'm Director of Education here at the RSA. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this lunchtime talk. Now, official notice is over. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Gavin Essler. Gavin needs little introduction. As all of you know, he's one of our leading broadcasters and a regular on our screens as one of the main anchors of Newsnight. My partner calls him the nice one in Newsnight. He's also the main presenter of Dateline London on BBC World and BBC News Channel, a regular writer and commentator across the print media, and a successful novelist. I didn't know this until earlier today, but he's written how many novels? Five novels. And somehow he's just found the time to write a new book, Lessons from the Top, which has just been published by Profile. The book draws on Gavin's decades of experience as one of our top interviewers to show how all great leaders, whether in the fields of business, politics or culture, share the art of storytelling, crafting and sustaining powerful leadership narratives to engage, persuade and bring about change. It's a really fascinating exploration of what it takes to reach and stay at the top in today's world, and we're really delighted you're able to join us today, Gavin, to give us a sneak preview of some of the book's insights. So without further ado, over to you, Gavin.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for those very kind words, and it's a big honour for me to be here. And I'm also very pleased with that introduction, because I'm extremely wary of introductions since I introduced Alistair Campbell a couple of years ago at a big event. And he asked me how I was going to introduce him, and I said, as the Prime Minister's former press secretary, and he said, oh, well, that's all right, that'll do. And then he got up on the stage and he said, I'm very pleased with the introduction today, because last week I was in Leeds, where I was introduced as, please welcome Alistair Campbell, the most evil man in Britain. And I'm also very pleased to be called the nice one on Newsnight. That's very nice. At least you have some sort of clue as to who I am. I was on a plane a couple of years ago, coming back from Malaysia, and one of the flight attendants said, oh, well, I'm a big admirer of your work. Would you like some champagne? I said, oh, yes, please. Thank you very much. And for the next 20 minutes, as my head got bigger and bigger and bigger, this flight attendant gave me more and more champagne and told me what a wonderful fellow I was and how fantastic I was and how he'd followed my career for years and years and years. And then he said, well, look, I've got to get back to the other passengers now, but maybe you can tell us, what's your next assignment, Mr. Alagaya? The point of my book, I suppose, is that every single one of us tells stories. We tell stories when we apply for a job. We call it a curriculum vitae, or we tell stories when we go for a job interview. We tell stories if you run a business, when you go into a bank and say, please give me some money because I need to expand my business. You tell a story about yourself, you tell a story about your business. You tell stories when you go on a date. There's all kinds of things that you do when you actually find yourself, if you think about it, telling a story. Every one of us does that. Leaders just do it a bit better than the rest of us. And they do it in a more organized fashion. And while there are many qualities that leaders have to have, and there are many different qualities depending upon the type of leadership, decision-making, creativity, and so on, the one key feature of every leader, at least every leader I've ever met, is to be able to tell a story in order to have followers. Because without followers, you're not much of a leader, are you? So, Lessons from the Top is about the power of these stories, how they're created, and what kind of stories connect with people. Just to give you a couple of examples, what I call leadership stories. These are just very brief headlines where the leader writes a headline for journalists like me, but also it becomes what Germans call an Ohrwurm, an earwig that gets in your ear like that pop song that you don't actually like very much, but you can't forget it. Mrs. Thatcher said she was the grocer's daughter from Grantham. Tony Blair said, I'm a pretty straight sort of guy. Nelson Mandela, there's different methods of telling stories. For instance, Nelson Mandela, when he was tried in an apartheid court, he chose to turn up at the court wearing traditional Xhosa dress. Now, this wasn't because that was the wardrobe opportunity of that morning. He was telling a story about who he was, an African leader in a white man's court and going to be railroaded in injustice. And you remember probably just a few years ago, At the Rugby World Cup in South Africa, he told a very different story about the new South Africa when he wore a Springbok shirt. He was telling a story about, I'm the leader of a new multiracial rainbow nation. I also talk about what I call, anyway, counter-stories and pre-stories. The counter-stories are the stories that your enemies tell about you, and the pre-stories are the kind of judgments we make about a leader or a person we're about to meet before we meet them. Journalists are particularly prone to the pre-stories. You might call them prejudices as well. A couple of examples of a counter-story. Remember I said Tony Blair's story was, I'm a pretty straight sort of guy. It's more complicated than that, but I'm just trying to give you some headlines. Remember the T-shirt after the first, after the Gulf War? Blyer. Now, there was a counter-story in one word. Mrs. Thatcher, the grocer's daughter from Grantham, was also known as Mrs. Thatcher, Milk Snatcher. And there was a great counter-story about her put about by the Russians, that she was the Iron Lady. And I cannot think what it must have been like in Downing Street when they found out that the Soviet communists were calling Mrs. Thatcher the Iron Lady. Thank you very much for doing my storytelling for me. I'm sure she must have thought of. And just think of the storytelling power in that phrase, a grocer's daughter from Grantham. I mean, what she was telling you was, she's a daughter, not a son, so thereby unlike any other leader of this country or any other leader of the Conservative Party. She's from Grantham. She's not part of the metropolitan elite. And she's a grocer's daughter. So she's not posh. She's not one of the old Etonians, although I think most of us would find it very difficult to imagine her serving in Londis. So it was a particular type of story that she was telling there. Bill Clinton, the first time I met him, and I know the first time a number of other people met him, we had a long conversation. It was in New Hampshire in 1991, and during the conversation he slipped in that he was just a boy from Hope, meaning Hope, Arkansas. What a brilliant little story that was. Only slightly undermined by the fact that much of his growing up was also done in Hot Springs, which is a gambling town in Arkansas, which isn't quite the same. But the story was there. Leaders like novelists or Hollywood scriptwriters have one particular technique which I find very interesting. I call it the violation of expectations. And you just heard it in that little anecdote about Alistair Campbell. You don't expect a great communicator, and he's a truly great communicator, to get on a stage and make reference to himself as the most evil man in Britain. But just think what that did to an audience. They all laughed, as you did. They all remembered it. And then they all thought, actually, maybe he's not quite the most evil man in Britain, whatever you may think of his policies. Maybe some of you who think he probably is. I don't know. It's up to you. Steve Jobs of Apple did it in a very different way. He violated expectations by, well, let's put in your mind a picture of Steve Jobs launching any product that you can think of. You know exactly how he's dressed. He's wearing an open-neck shirt, no jacket. He's wearing some scruffy jeans and some trainers that look as if they could have been cleaned before he got on the stage. And compare that to the kind of story that Bill Gates told. He was often very buttoned up when he made any of his media appearances. Now, what you got from Steve Jobs, which I thought, again, was a brilliant piece of leadership storytelling, is, I'm not a corporate kind of guy. I'm a cool kind of geek. While he was running one of the biggest corporations in the world. It was a brilliant storytelling act, in my view. One of the things that interests me is the vocabulary that leaders use. And in this next bit, you might find some words that you're familiar with from British politics. About 20 years ago, Newt Gingrich, who was an unsuccessful presidential candidate this time, but was Speaker of the House of Representatives from the 1994 elections onwards, so from 1995, Gingrich wrote in the early 90s, privately for Republican candidates, very, very interesting advice for them to use the words that they should use when talking about themselves and also words that they should use when talking about their opponents. Here's Gingrich's list of what he called optimistic governing words. Candid, care, challenge, children, courage, debate, dream, environment, family, hard work, legacy, liberty, and so on. For your opponent, here's the all-purpose Newt Gingrich vocabulary. Bureaucracy, cheat, collapse, corrupt, cynicism, decay, destroy, destructive, failure. Now, you may think you have heard these words here, nothing to do with Newt Gingrich, because if you take some of those words out of the speeches of many leaders in this country and elsewhere, and in translation in European leaders and so on, there might not be much left. But my contention is that as followers, and we're all followers of something, I'll get on to that in a moment, we're all followers of something, we actually understand that these words are vacuous. We understand that this is an all-purpose storytelling toolkit. And in the document, Gingrich is not saying Republicans stand for the following policies, because policies have got nothing to do with it. It's got to do with a vocabulary that you can use to create a particular type of impression. And I think that is a slight problem for us as followers or as citizens, because I think this audience, the Newsnight audience, Radio 4 audience, readers of some of our better newspapers, see through it. We don't know why we see through it sometimes, but we do see through it. And we realize that these words have got no particular value. They're just words of abuse or words that are supposed to make you think well of the person using these stories or telling the stories in that way. I also try to explain the power of pictures. The one leader whose leadership team really got this right was Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan is someone rather like George W. Bush, and I suspect Mitt Romney, who is very misunderstood, or perhaps, as George W. Bush would say, misunderestimated on this side of the Atlantic. Reagan really was a great communicator. Anybody who's elected twice to the presidency of the United States is going to be a good communicator. And Reagan was extraordinary. One of the things that the Reagan team, and I talked to Michael Deaver about this, who was his, I think it was assistant chief of staff or deputy chief of staff or something was his title, but he was basically there to make Reagan look good. And so when Reagan had to make a big policy announcement about the environment, and let's agree that his credentials on the environment were not that of the Green Party, what they would do is put him in an open-neck shirt, stick him on a horse, and put him in a canyon somewhere in the western United States. Now, he could have been announcing that he was concreting over Grand Canyon or turning it into a cement factory, but the pictures tell you another story. There's this good-looking older guy on a horse in the American West, and the American West was the star of that story. It didn't matter, in a way, what he was actually talking about, because sometimes the words just pass people by. It's something which, as you'll see if you read the book, the Reagan White House was very aware of. They even congratulated an excellent reporter called Leslie Stahl, who did what she thought was an amazing investigative report about some of Reagan's policies by going to the places where Reagan was making speeches. And the White House, she thought, was going to cut her off from any cooperation. Instead, they phoned her up and said, "Way to go, Leslie, that was great." And she was puzzled. And she said, "But didn't you hear what I said?" And the response was, "Nobody heard what you said. They saw what the president looked like." And that was the point. Now, I could go on and talk for quite a while about this, and I hope to do some questions and answers, because I think that might explore some of your interests. But essentially, I think there are three leadership stories that all the leaders I've come across tell. The "Who am I" story as a person. I'm the Iron Lady. I'm the boy from Hope. The "Who are we" story, which could be, we're the new Democrats, we're different from the bad old Democrats, or we're compassionate conservatives, or whatever it is. That's a story about who we are as a group. And the final part is, where is my leadership going to take us? What is our common purpose? And in a way, I'm less interested in that. This is not a book about policies, or who was a good president, or a good prime minister. This is a book about who was a good communicator, whose story connected with people, which is why Reagan is in it, Mrs. Thatcher is in it, there's a lot of Blair in it, and a lot of Clinton too, as well as some cultural leaders and business leaders. One thing which has certainly changed is that we have become a much more confessional culture. The media has changed since 1989, I think, very profoundly. And I say 1989 because the fall of the wall seemed to herald in all kinds of changes that we haven't really quite assessed yet. But there's no we can go into detail as how the media has changed if you want, but just to give you some examples from the last election, which was the kicking off point for this book. What I didn't want to write was a book of anecdotes, so here's an interesting person I met and here's a funny story. What happened during the last election was I was sitting in front of the TV watching Alistair Darling being interviewed by Piers Morgan. And here we have the Chancellor of the United Kingdom during the worst economic crisis of our lifetime being asked by Piers Morgan, and I quote, "Are you good in bed?" A subject which had not occurred to me, possibly because I'm the nice one on Newsnight, I don't know. Nick Clegg was asked how many lovers he had. David Cameron was asked by a newspaper when he conceived his youngest child, whether he'd ever committed adultery. Gordon Brown was asked about family tragedies and so on. And I started to think, yeah, there's Barack Obama, who published an autobiography where he talked about his drug use as a young man. Tony Blair's wife, Cherie, talking about when the youngest child was conceived. And I thought, can you imagine Winston Churchill being asked any of these questions? Winston, do you drink too much to be Prime Minister? You can't, can you? It's completely inconceivable. So what has changed? And that got me thinking about the nature of the media, the nature of the stories that leaders now think they have to tell, because that's what people will ask them about, and whether they really do have to tell these stories, or whether they could say, hold on a minute, why are you asking me that? That's got nothing to do with my job. I'm going to wrap up in just a few minutes, but I want to leave you with a couple of stories about Ronald Reagan, which I find quite interesting, because he was a great storyteller publicly, but also a leader's image is partly the image of storytelling in his inner circle, the stories that people tell behind the president's back or the prime minister's back, and which may change your views of that person. One which was told to me by Michael Deaver is that at a great moment of crisis, Ronald Reagan, who had a somewhat relaxed view of the working day, would tend to turn up about 9 o'clock in the morning in the Oval Office from the living quarters, which were 2 minutes walk away, and put in a couple of hours, might have a little nap, and then tend to go off in the middle of the afternoon. He came in one morning with his dog, which was described to me by Deaver as an untrained mutt. Now, I'm the owner of an untrained mutt, so I have a bit of fellow feeling about this. It had been a moment of great crisis. It had been a foreign policy crisis, and all these big barons, really, of the Reagan administration, there were some really big egos in that administration, quite extraordinary characters, had been meeting through the night to decide what to do about the foreign policy crisis. 9 o'clock, the president walks in, dog runs round and round and round in the Oval Office. And one person, who Deaver named to me, but I think I should keep quiet about, said, "Mr. President, one day that dog is going to piss on your desk." And Ronald Reagan said, "Everyone else does." Now, I tell that story because it was part of the communicable charm of the president. Nothing to do with the policies, and we can go through, you know, the details of the Iran-Contra affair and supply-side economics and the cuts that were made and how he treated PATCO, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, and so on. The details of that will tend not to stick in your mind, I suspect, whereas the detail of the story, particularly if you were involved or you were told by one of the players, they would tend to stick in your mind. And I want to end, because I want to take as many questions as possible, with another Reagan story, which comes from a good friend of mine who's got a very fine beard. And he, as a very young reporter, met Reagan in the White House, and they had a chat about this foreign policy thing that my friend was reporting on. And then Reagan said at the end of it, "Well, what's next for you?" He said, "I'm shaving off my beard because I have to go to New York to meet my bosses." And Reagan said, "Why are you shaving off your beard?" He said, "Well, because my editor-in-chief doesn't like beards. He thinks they're unprofessional." So the guy leaves. Reagan goes back to the interesting chores that he has to do as President of the United States. And 2 weeks later, my friend, who's back on the job in his bureau, foreign bureau, gets a phone call from his editor-in-chief who says, "What the hell did you say to the President of the United States?" And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, I had a breakfast meeting with Ronald Reagan, and I was giving him a very hard time about his illiberal policies. And he turned to me and said, 'I might be a liberal, but I'll let a guy wear a beard.'" Part of the theme, and this is, I'll throw it open to questions now, is part of the theme of the book is that we think we understand human nature. We don't understand, perhaps, whether 2 million or 2 billion or 20 billion is the right amount of money to pay for aircraft carriers. Those of us who are interested in policy, and I'm sure the people in this room are, do pay attention to the bits that interest you. But all of us think we get character, and we get character pretty much through stories. And some of those stories are shaped, these ones were private ones, but Reagan, if you remember, after he was shot, he said, "Honey, I forgot to duck," to his wife. That was actually a quote from Gene Tunney, a boxer who got knocked out in the ring. So the stories that he told and that people told me about him and about other presidents and prime ministers don't occur like pieces of gold naturally in the landscape. They are manufactured, and they're manufactured for a public purpose, which is generally to make you think well of the leader. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gavin. And it's that was a fascinating introduction to a book that has so much more, including the bits I found particularly interesting were the interviews you did with the Prime Minister of Pakistan, but also the references to Lady Gaga and Angelina Jolie as well. So maybe we'll reflect on that as well later.
Well, the Prime Minister of Pakistan is a good example. This is President Zardari. And there is a phenomenon familiar to those of us in television called dressing the set, which means you make sure... You wouldn't put this background, I'm sorry. You put something behind the people that you're interviewing, or they put something behind them to make it look authentic and real and tell a story. And so, for instance, with Chancellor Merkel, the interview point, she does very few interviews. She does none with foreign journalists. I managed to get one earlier this year. Had the German flag and had the Reichstag behind her. Now, that wasn't an accident. It wasn't just, oh, that's the only room available. No, I tell you what, we'll do it in the boardroom. That's where she wanted the interview. And President Zardari, we knew there'd be a Pakistan flag in the background. And, of course, we want interviews to look nice on television. But 2 minutes before he appeared, suddenly behind him appeared a picture of Benazir Bhutto, his wife who'd been murdered by terrorists, and Jinnah, the first leader of Pakistan. Now, again, these didn't fall from the sky. They were placed by his aides behind him. And they were saying in that story, I'm the legitimate leader of Pakistan. I'm the heir to Jinnah. And David Cameron accused me of facing both ways on terrorism. My own wife died for the cause of democracy in Pakistan. He didn't have to talk about them, but they were there all the time. So, and it's not... And it's not just political leaders. Does anybody remember the Queen saying thank you to the nation after the Jubilee? There was a picture there as the Queen gave her speech, and it was of William and Kate. I think it was taken on the wedding day, and it was there. And what was that picture telling us as a story? Subliminally, it was telling us the monarchy is going to go on. This is continuity. This is not even the next generation. It's the one after that. And again, believe me, it was no accident.
The first question, Gavin... most of the examples you give do come from the West, particularly the US, but also the UK. And that's partly about your own experience. But as global power and leadership certainly without doubt moves east from the Atlantic to the Pacific, if you like, but also hopefully moves south, might that have an impact and an influence on leadership and the way storytelling happens through that leadership?
I think it's certainly true. I mean, I'm not the expert on China. My daughter is, who's sitting over there, we should ask her. and in fact, Deng Xiaoping does appear in the book because he told an extraordinary story. I mean, I think Deng Xiaoping is an amazing leader of China, and he, among other things, his earwig would be socialism with Chinese characteristics. which he said repeatedly. That's a brilliant phrase, given that he'd been purged a couple of times from the Communist Party. I mean, what's he saying there? He's saying anything you like about socialism, well, I'm still that, but anything you don't like, well, I'm something different. And compassionate conservatism, when George W. Bush made his speech in Philadelphia, and he talked about being a compassionate conservative. A friend of mine, a Republican friend of mine in the audience, said to me, that means exactly the same as Deng Xiaoping and socialism with Chinese characteristics. He's saying, anything you like about the Republican Party, I'm still that, but anything you don't like, I'm something different. And so there is an Eastern method of storytelling which I'm much less familiar with. It's very difficult to find anything good written about Deng Xiaoping that's authoritative. But there are a series of storytelling things that he did which helped build modern China. They're very simple. I mean, he was very famous for saying it doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white as long as it catches the rat. So he's saying, I'm not going to pursue the ideological path of Chairman Mao. I'm going to pursue a pragmatic path, and every Chinese peasant is going to get it because we all know about cats and rats. So if power moves more to the east or the south, well, I think actually it will move very gradually to the east, but I'm not one of those who think that, you know, sometime in the next 2 years China will rule the world. I think China's got lots of other problems. But there'll be different methods of storytelling appropriate for a Chinese audience. And I suspect it will certainly not be through official channels, because the Chinese do things somewhat differently.
Right, and my last question is about my own area, which is around education. Some of the skills and qualities you described feel that they are needed for all of us, whether we are official leaders or not. And I just wonder whether you think there's anything more our or other education systems can do to develop skills for storytelling and also for critical analysis of other people's stories within our schools and beyond.
Because part of it, as you know, I mean, I've tried to break it down into leadership lessons. Those of us who, if you want to lead in your business, if you're a deputy head teacher and you want to be a head teacher, what stories should you tell? How should you impress people about the good things about yourself? And we all do it. But the other thing I wanted to try to do was deconstruct how leaders do it so we can be, I'm not suggesting more cynical about it, but I am suggesting more critical of the kind of stuff that we are fed by the media and or through the media and deconstruct it. And so therefore, to teach that in schools, to get people to look critically at what they see on television in schools, wouldn't be, to me, a soft class, nor would it be a soft class to read a newspaper and say, what does it actually mean when it says, friends of Joe say, well, what does that mean? It probably means they've made it up, is my view.
That's not because I don't have any friends.
That's not because you don't have any friends.
Okay, let's open it up to the floor now.
Gavin, you talked about the confessional culture, and there's also a big viral culture now in relation to use of digital media, and I just wonder what you thought the impact of that was on leaders' abilities to control the stories that they tell about themselves.
I think there's two bits to the viral culture. One is it is uncontrollable, and it's uncontrollable even for the leaders in China, who, you know, people can read about Bo Xilai on the net, despite the various measures that are taken. On the other hand, a lot of it is really unreliable. I mean, I was slight aside here, but if you read Wikipedia entries, they have this kind of pseudo-scholarship where they'll have footnotes. And then you read the footnotes, and they're sourced to newspapers that you wouldn't put in the bottom of your budgie's cage. So that's what you see on the internet. So I think there's a number of things at play here. One is reliable information, stuff you can trust. Doesn't mean to say everybody's going to get it right if you read The Economist. Broadly, they try to do a good job and try to get it right and try to correct it if it's wrong. You don't get that very much on the internet. The other part of it is, and it's something Tony Blair writes about very eloquently in A Journey, his autobiography. He broadly thinks that the media is no longer interested in policy, and I think he's got a fair point with some sections of the media. But he also says the pace of change and pace of events now is so different from even 10 or 15 years ago. So while on Newsnight and other places we sometimes give politicians a hard time because they're accountable, I think we should also be aware of the speed with which we expect them to craft a response to things, which maybe it might be a good idea if they had time to think about. Because I'd rather get it right and be accused. I mean, the two things that we, the media, sometimes say about politicians, which I think are really silly, are he or she is a ditherer. People say that about Merkel. Some German newspapers, she's a ditherer. Well, I'd rather she takes time, or Obama or David Cameron takes time and gets it right, than responds just because we've got a four-hour news cycle in this country. And so, and the other one is he or she's an actor. Because they used to say that about Blair, and there's lots of things about Tony Blair you can criticise, but I think that's quite funny, really. I mean, Winston Churchill's speeches, which we've all heard, were delivered in the House of Commons, but the ones we've heard weren't delivered in the House of Commons. They were re-recorded later in the BBC. So was Winston Churchill an actor? I mean, I think he was slightly better than that, but he did have the acting capacity.
Given the increasing visibility of speech writers and stylists in creating those stories, do you think the role of the leaders as storytellers being diminished?
That's an interesting question. It's certainly true that, I mean, Churchill once said, "History will be kind to me, for I shall write it." So he knew he was the storyteller in his own story. And Julius Caesar famously, of course, wrote about the Gallic Wars, where Julius Caesar, the leader, was talked about in the third person. And Julius Caesar, the author, thought Julius Caesar, the warrior, was a very good chap. Shockingly. I mean, I don't see any problem with it. It's certainly true that Reagan's rhetoric was made beautiful by Peggy Noonan, who is not very familiar even to most Americans, but she was a great speechwriter. And I don't see anything wrong with that. The leader doesn't have, any leader doesn't have more than 24 hours in a day, and so he or she doesn't necessarily need to write all his speeches. If you're getting us onto the subject of spin, I mean, that's the pejorative term, but which leaders have not had spin doctors? I mean, the Christian story is told by the apostles and, you know, and the books of the Bible written down by people who you could say were spin doctors. So that's as old as history, I think.
Thank you for that talk. You've given a very cogent explanation of what a good story will be for a leader. That presumably is a necessary condition of leadership, not sufficient. Have you given any thought to what complements that in terms of what makes a sufficiently good leader?
Yeah, well, as I said, leaders have to have a whole series of qualities, but they're different for different leaders and at different times. But I focus entirely on storytelling because I think that is the necessary skill, absolutely the necessary skill. And, you know, one of the reasons why, to take Churchill again, who doesn't feature very much in the book, but he was out of favour for many years because he wasn't the right man for the right time, even though he remained a great storyteller in a different way because he wrote so much. So I'm not really interested in this book in telling you that, you know, being decisive or being creative or having those kind of things is a necessary skill. What I do say, though, is that it's not just the stories leaders tell, it's the stories told about them that are important. And to give you one good example, the start of the Clinton presidency was shambolic. And, I mean, I remember quite a senior member of the administration who didn't get Secret Service clearance for months. And I had Secret Service clearance, so I could walk through into the White House, and this person, who was actually working there, as opposed to being a sort of parasite like me, couldn't get in. It was just terribly badly handled. And Clinton was late for everything. In fact, we used to take bets as to how long he would, you know, there'd be a meeting with various people. I remember one with some military people. And I said to the guy next to me, who happened to be a colonel in the US Air Force, "How late do you think the commander-in-chief will be?" And he said, in a very kind of deadpan way, he said, "When we say the bombing begins at dawn, we don't mean dawn plus 47. Plus 47 minutes. So he obviously figured 47 minutes late. The reason I tell that story is Clinton turned it around. And I have a picture on my desk which captures the following moment. I was due to do an interview with him in the Roosevelt Room at the White House at 2 o'clock one afternoon, which was a bit tight because I was trying to get it on the news with the time difference, trying to get it on that night's BBC News. And at about 2 minutes to 2 in the Roosevelt Room, the two cameras and lots of lights and the crew and everything and lots of White House people running around in circles. We blew every fuse in the Roosevelt Room. All the lights went off, and the White House staff went into a bit of a panic. And I said, and I thought this was a real take charge moment for me, I said, don't worry, he's always late. At which point, a voice behind me said, who's always late? Now, that was, so I've got a photograph of that moment, and he was very good-natured about it, actually, and it was all fine. But it was the moment when I thought, well, maybe he's actually got the presidency, the mechanics of the presidency, back on track. And that was a story, he changed the story that we told about him to ourselves. It wasn't something that people reported on a lot, but it did change the story. So punctuality, for example, is quite a good thing on a leader. And if a leader doesn't realize that the people around him are going to tell stories, he's not much of a leader.
Which of our current leaders are true leaders rather than just followers or former successful leaders?
I have no idea. I mean, the book is about how they tell stories, and a true leader is up to you, really. It's not up to me. What is a true leader? I don't know. Different people have different views.
Gavin, you spoke about the cultural shift which has occurred in media's handling of politicians and celebrities since around 1989. You gave this very graphic example of Piers Morgan putting this stupid question to the Chancellor at the last election. Now, what would you say would be the effect, generally, if celebrities and politicians were to turn around and say to the interviewer, look, that is none of your business?
Yeah, well, I have thought about that without reaching any great conclusion. I think the problem is this, as I see it anyway, and you're welcome to disagree. A magazine called Hola was created in fascist Spain by the family of a man called Eduardo Sanchez Junco, and it became Hello magazine. And by the 1990s, this kind of magazine culture took off everywhere. It's very, very popular, and I don't see anything wrong with it. But what it did for celebrity culture was put celebrities in beautiful places, take nice photographs of them, and ask them nice questions so they look good. And it looks like an advertisement, a very glossy advertisement, because basically it is an advertisement. And that has affected that kind of culture, not only the clones and magazines and so on, but there are also newspapers do the same thing. And TV does the same thing. And Oprah, although I have great respect for Oprah Winfrey as an interviewer, because she actually listens to answers. That's kind of amazing, really. But that kind of treatment of celebrities, it seems to me, has changed completely what we expect to hear. And what we expect to hear is much more intimate details of, quote, their real lives, without recognizing that their, quote, real lives are shaped as stories for us. And I think politics has become totally infected by that. I'm not sure there's any way of turning the clock back. I really don't think that there is, whether you'd like it or not. I don't think there is.
I guess Gordon Brown kind of tried through not revealing stories, and that created difficulties.
Gordon Brown's a good example. I mean, he is somebody who, again, whatever you think of his policies, was he a true leader or not? I'm not interested in that. But as somebody who introduced himself to the British public, he did a very bad job of that. How many of you remember the day where he left Downing Street, and there he was with his wife and children, and there was a very lovely family photograph? Gentlemen, a lot of you are nodding. It was quite extraordinary, and I checked with some colleagues. Nobody remembered anything like that, because he didn't use his children as props, as storytelling devices. Now, that is a decision he took, and you may say it's a very honourable one, but I wonder whether in the kind of climate that we're in, whether that is an ineffective one, and whether it has come to be expected that political leaders talk about their families and put them forward in a different way. And talk about, I mean, again, it was never a secret that he was blind in one eye, but he didn't go on about it. He didn't say, you know, I used to play rugby. He didn't talk about it. And maybe in straightforward communication terms, he missed a trick. Whether you think it's honourable or a good thing or not is a different matter.
Perhaps following on from that, do you believe there's any link between the way modern political leaders tell stories and the increase in apathy, at least in the West, in terms of voting and the electorate?
Yes. Basically. I mean, Berlusconi. Well, there you are. I won't say any more. I think you get the point. I mean, he's somebody who spent a lot of money sending out to every voter in Italy little brochures telling them about the knight, il cavalieri, I think it is, in Italian, telling stories about himself. So it seems to me it's one of the weaknesses of our democracies that if we vote for the storyteller rather than the person who may be the true leader or the effective leader. And how do you tell the difference? That's what I've tried to get to, is here's some clues to how you might tell the difference. I've got a chapter called Authenticity and How to Fake It, which might give you a clue.
Yes, just on the question of manufactured storytelling, I understand that there is an interest in it and fun in it, but I have always felt personally there's a huge danger in it. Do you not think that manufactured storytelling has made a large contribution to the economic mess we're in?
Undoubtedly. I mean, I'm sure it has. But just, well, let me give you an example. If you think this is a new phenomenon, Moses didn't say, I've been having a big think and here's 10 rules and we're all going to live by them from now on because we're the people of Israel. Moses said, I went up into a mountaintop and God gave me these things written on. He gave a story. And because it's a story, all religious leaders do this. All religious leaders have done it through history. Because it's a story, we remember it. So there's nothing wrong with stories. What's wrong is lying or telling stories about... what was the one? I've invented the new paradigm. Do you remember that? There were a lot of, particularly in the United States, people were talking about the new paradigm. There'd be constant growth and everything would be fine and we'd eliminate boom and bust and so on. That was wrong. Obviously, it was wrong. We are now recognizing. So there's nothing wrong with being a good storyteller and telling a good story about yourself or telling about what happened. And that's as old as history, really.
I grew up during the Profumo affair.
Ah.
And I think since then it hasn't been quite the same, has it? With the continuing economic difficulties we're going to have, do you think we'll revert from being interested in politicians' private lives to the policies they're actually trying to propagate?
Well, that's a good question. And so is the Profumo affair, actually. One of the interesting things about the Profumo affair is it was about sex in high places, but it was not a newspaper that uncovered the story. If I remember correctly, it was George Wigg speaking in the House of Commons, which brought it to everyone's attention. And it was brought to our attention not because he was sleeping with a prostitute or whatever it was. It was because she was sleeping with the Russian? Exactly. So there was a political dimension to a sex scandal. Now there's a sex dimension to a sex scandal, which has got no particular political dimension until it becomes, as it was with Clinton and Lewinsky, it becomes a different type of scandal. And I've got a chapter called How to Handle a Scandal, in which, not surprisingly, Bill Clinton features quite heavily, because he did handle that very well. I don't think, I'm not good in the prediction business, but I don't think we can turn the clock back. I don't think we'll go back to a different time. There is a theory, which I kind of subscribe to, that actually the aberration isn't now, that the aberration was the period from 1914 to 1989, because we were the world was at war, from 1914 to 1989, Cold War and so on, but basically we were at war, and so leaders were treated very differently. But if you look back at some of the very scurrilous pamphlets produced in the United States, in the early 1800s, for example, or in Britain and some of the very scurrilous cartoons and so on, there was always a very robust yellow press kind of culture. And maybe we're going back to an earlier model, and that what was different was that period. Because we were, from 1914 to 1989, it seemed that we were just that away from destruction of one kind or another. Maybe.
And that may decline further in terms of the way we
and it may do, so maybe we should just get used to it. buy shares in Hello Magazine.
Gavin, you've talked about leaders communicating, but you haven't mentioned oratory at all. Is that because you think in a television age, oratory is dead and no longer needed as for a church or a Lloyd George? But then if you think about Obama or Clinton, oratory has been crucially important in telling their stories.
I agree totally, actually. I don't talk a great deal about oratory, although I do use a phrase that for some politicians, the whole thing is like snakes and ladders, that oratory and speaking is the ladder, and appearing on television programs with people like me is possibly the snake. You might, I should also say that question came from the only other person who took Bill Clinton's candidacy seriously in October 1991, am I right? And saying, I think oratory is hugely important, but not for everybody. I think, unfortunately, lots of people get their messages in bite-sized chunks, sliced up for television, and we're all busy. We're all, you know, we all have lives. How many of us actually go and listen to a whole speech? I think it's really worth it, because then you see with Gingrich is a great speaker, Clinton's a great speaker, Obama's an extraordinary speaker. And if you hear the political speeches actually in this country, we're not too bad. Really, we're not too bad. But most of us don't bother to listen because we've got jobs or we've got lives and so on. And that's a bit of a pity. I mean, the great public meetings of the past, wouldn't that be wonderful to return to that? That's something I would like to return to.
I wonder why you'd put Boris in this, because he's got something that you can't buy, and that's people like him. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of pejorative stories out there that I don't know about, but every time he appears on the television, he gets more votes. Mm-hmm. People like him.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really interesting
question. That's not a transferable skill.
It's not a transferable skill, but what's interesting is to look at the way he does it. I mean, you could say, if you look at... Do you remember Nadine Dorries, the MP, said you know, the Prime Minister and George Osborne are, I think she said, two arrogant posh boys who don't know the price of milk. Now, Boris Johnson comes very much from the same class, sounds very much the same, and so on. What is it about him that connects with people? Now, you could say he's done a great job as mayor, and again, that's the policy thing, but there is something that people find very likable, and my contention is, although he doesn't appear in the book, I don't think, is it's the authenticity question. He doesn't pretend to be anything other than he is. You know, cripes, yaroo, tin hat time. Sorry, that was, I apologise, Boris, if you're watching. That was a terrible impersonation. But you know what I mean. And I was at Edinburgh Book Festival last week, and a couple of people were talking about it. And it was very interesting because he comes from the part of England that a lot of people in Scotland wouldn't like, the Etonian posh and so on, and yet they relate to him as a person. And that's a very interesting question, as how he connects. But I'm absolutely convinced it's to do with he seems authentic. He doesn't seem anything other than he is. He's completely unapologetic about liking Pericles, the great orator. And even people who don't know who Pericles is understand that and they get that.
So if the advice to leaders is to tell a good story, what would your advice be to those that oppose leaders?
Oh, to those who oppose leaders. Well, you've got to find an authentic counter-story. Why people in the Soviet Union leadership thought that calling Margaret Thatcher the Iron Lady was going to be detrimental to her, I never quite understood. Maybe there was something, I don't know enough about Russia, something going on. Here's an example of the way in which negative storytelling or counter-stories have been tried. Barack Obama, remember I said, who am I, who are we, what is our common purpose, are the three big stories. Every politician is attacked on what is our common purpose, because we all disagree as to where this country should go or what we should do with the NHS and so on. And Obama has been attacked about what he's doing about healthcare, which is just normal politics. But he's also been attacked in a way very few American politicians have been, about who he is. You know, the allegations that he's not American, that he's not a Christian, that he's a socialist, that he is, what's the other one, that he's basically out of touch Ivy League elite. Now that's very interesting, and those kind of stories, it seems to me, are very damaging, because they undermine, if you can't explain to people who you are as a person, or you get that wrong, or you lie about it, that's really difficult. And that, to me, is why some political attacks are very, very personal, and this confessional culture opens people up to that, because it's all very well to appear in on a nice sofa interview talking about your private life, but then that opens up this whole area to your opponents to attack you on.
I'm wondering, and it follows on from the last conversation, whether in your experience women leaders have a more challenging time telling their stories than male leaders. And I asked this, I was bemused a couple of days ago to see that you can go and see an exhibition of Margaret Thatcher's wardrobe and how it shifted through time. And I don't ever remember seeing an exhibition of Churchill's wardrobe or even Boris or Bill Clinton. Do women have a harder time getting their view of their stories across because they have to first fight perceptions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a pre-story about women leaders, a general pre-story. One is the ditherer, that's a thing, and Margaret Thatcher was brilliant at coping with that. I mean, to be called the Iron Lady means you're not probably going to be a ditherer. So, but I think you're right, and it's not just my opinion. Michelle Bachelet, who's in the book, was the president of Chile, and before that was the defense minister of Chile, and is a woman. We talked a lot about this, and it was very interesting. When she came here to meet the Queen, the Chilean press wrote about what she wore. They also wrote a bit about, you know, the content of the visit, but it was about what she wore, which they'd never have done with a male leader. But the other thing she said, I mean, she was a very, very shrewd leader. Her father had been killed in the coup against the Allende in the 70s, and so when she became defense minister, she was very concerned about how she would relate to the military in Chile, given the kind of culture that you're implying here. And so what she did was she called all the generals and admirals and whatever else together and got them together and said, I just want you to know, I'm going to misquote her slightly, but this is the gist of it. I just want you to know that I'm a woman, divorced, an agnostic, and a socialist. All the sins together. Long pause. But we will get on very well. Now, that is a very clever way of handling it, because she made it clear that she understood exactly what they were thinking, what their counter-story was, or pre-story, and she countered the counter-story. She was brilliant at doing that.
Can I assume that as an interviewer, you possibly have quite a unique characteristic in that can I assume that you're a linguist? And has the fact that you speak foreign languages helped you when interviewing? And does it give you a sort of an added interpretation if you're using an interpreter?
I think, yes. Although it's slightly confusing in a number of ways. One was when I attempted to speak German to Angela Merkel, and I did a bit, I suddenly realized that despite all my German friends saying she doesn't speak English, she speaks brilliant English, absolutely perfect English. So all this stuff about wearing the earpiece, and I mean, maybe she's taking more time to listen to questions. But she speaks better English than I speak German. And what was very funny was we talked about it afterwards, because one of the problems if you speak another language is that if you get a simultaneous translation, it's not simultaneous. It comes a few seconds later. And I found out with her and with Chirac, and it became Chirac, whose French even I could understand, it was absolutely schoolboy French, beautifully beautifully articulated and very slow, which I needed. I find the translation quite confusing. So it's good to speak at any level any other languages, because it puts you in touch with the culture, and also slightly disarms the other leader. If you speak Ollanta Humala, who's now the president of Peru, I spoke to him a little bit in Spanish, and we played chess together for the interview. But again, I was telling a story about me, which is I sort of understand Latin American culture a bit, and he was telling a story to everybody watching, which is I may be a former colonel in the very macho Peruvian army, but I know how to play chess. So maybe we were both playing little games there. For the record, he beat me quite easily. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.